I saw my dentist, too, another beauty. I said to him, Doc, look at my teeth. They're all getting yellow. He told me to wear a brown necktie.
To me, it's a little weird for a doctor to specialize in proctology, for that matter. I'm sure he has his reasons, but who makes that decision? Come out of medical school, here's the whole human body. Where do I want to hang? Okay, no, feet, nothing in the front. What do you got in the back? No, back of the head, no. Yeah. Now we're getting somewhere.
What's wrong with you?
It's either this show or indigestion. I hope it's indigestion.
Why?
It'll get better in a little while.
Now open your mouth and let's have a look at that brain.
We have an obesity epidemic in the USA. One out of every three Americans weighs as much as the other two, which to me...
What's up, Fletcher?
Your cholesterol!
Here we go, Wednesday afternoon. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday house call, folks. And I'd love to hear from you. We had a couple of people who were hanging on the line last week, and we didn't get to them. And I'd hate for that to happen again this week. So call early if you can. We have every single phone line available. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, and 1-800-580-CFRA. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm just fine.
Good.
So, Ottawa Citizen this week. I know you talked to Steve about this this week, but we should revisit it because there's a response from the Ontario Medical Association, the OMA, today.
Okay.
This is probably the most disingenuous health reporting I've read in a long, long time. From the Citizen, some doctors' offices are cherry-picking wealthier patients with higher income earners 50% more likely than welfare recipients to be taken on as new patients. New Canadian research, in quotation marks, suggests. And nearly 10% of doctors' offices surveyed were conducting screening visits, essentially auditioning patients to see which ones would be willing to accept, they would be willing to accept into their practices, a direct violation of their own licensing body policy on accepting new patients. This was published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Research by Dr. Stephen Wang from the Center for Research on Inner City Health at the Li Ka-shing Knowledge Institute, St. Mike's Hospital, University of Toronto. Here's what they did. And I want to know if you think this is a legitimate way to conduct, again in quotation marks, research. This is research. They telephoned 375 randomly selected family physician and GP offices in Toronto from March of 2011 to July of 2011, posing either as an employee of a big bank or a welfare recipient. Mm-hmm. And they had a script.
Right.
One script said, "Hi, I'm calling because my welfare worker told me I need a family doctor for an annual checkup." And the other script said, "I'm calling. I just got transferred here. I work for a big bank and I need a family doctor." And their research showed, lo and behold, you're more likely to be taken on as a patient if you're the banker instead of the welfare recipient.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, you were right, Rob, in terms of how this was done. It was 375 offices. No physicians were contacted. I think it's very important to point that out, in that none of the interactions involved the physician answering those particular questions. It was staff in front. That being said, 375 calls, 69 of them resulted in appointments out of three. Now that we're talking about Toronto, 5-6 million people in Toronto now, Rob, I think.
Yep.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So 69 appointments, and on the basis of that, and then they parsed that 69 into how many of those fell under the script from the banker and the script from the welfare recipient, and it worked out to something like 40 something versus 20 something or other. It was still, so the difference was about 20 people out of those 60
callers posing as bank employees were significantly
Yeah.
More likely than callers posing as welfare recipients to be offered an appointment, 23% versus 14%.
Right. So the actual difference was 7%, the absolute difference was 7%, right, instead of the 50%, which is what they claim for relative change.
Right, but that is significant.
But the point is, one, it dealt with Toronto. It didn't deal with the entire province. It extrapolates to the entire province and says that somehow there's a problem. Secondly, how many people call up and say, hi, I'm a banker, or hi, I'm a welfare recipient, and I'd like to make an appointment? Is that the first thing that you say to someone when you call up a physician's office? No, you call up and say, hi, I'd like to know if I can see a family doctor. Do you have any positions available? That's the usual script. And if they used that script on the phone, you might see very different results. I don't know whether this was a bias for bankers versus welfare recipients, but I can tell you that there are not a lot of bankers that go see their family doctors because they pay the $1,500 to go see MedCan and all the other places in Toronto.
Right. Listen, can I ask you a question as a family doctor? Does the family doctor get paid any different if the patient they see is on welfare or a banker? You get paid the same.
It's exactly the same thing.
Right?
Yeah.
Whether you see the patient who's on welfare or whether you see the banker who runs a hedge fund,
you get paid the same.
You still get your $25 or whatever it is for 10 minutes. But listen to this. This is from the physician who did this study, Dr. Wang.
Right.
It is possible that talking about the front office staff.
Yeah.
It is possible that the doctors for whom they work have instructed them to select certain kinds of patients to be admitted into the practice.
It's speculation. He has no proof for that. It sounds like this guy has an axe to grind for some reason. You can only make and come to conclusions on the basis of hard evidence. This is not hard evidence. This is extrapolating from very small sample sizes and trying to encompass an entire province of 25,000 physicians, 13,000 family doctors, comprising thousands of clinics, and saying on the basis of 69 appointments made in 375 offices that this is pervasive across the province. And until they do an accurate assessment to test their hypothesis on all clinics, calling up every single one, and then finding out, is this more prevalent in Toronto? Is this more prevalent in Sault Ste. Marie? Is it more prevalent in Ottawa or wherever? Then you can come back and say something.
Okay. What about the issue of screening visits? Do doctors audition patients?
It's not auditioning. When I was taking on new patients, I would tell them outright, I don't care what kind of conditions you have. Doesn't matter to me how complicated things are. It's irrelevant whether you have one disease, no diseases, or 10 diseases. And I tell them that outright. I said, what is important to me, though, is this is how I run my practice. These are the rules of my practice. This is what I expect to be able to provide to you. And this is what I expect you to do in my practice. And if this is acceptable to you, fantastic. I like to get along with everybody. I don't want to argue about stuff. If you are overly demanding, if you are abusive to my front staff, then I do not want you here as a patient. And that I'll tell them that outright. So it's set out in the beginning. But I'll see them. And if they contravene what the rules were that they agreed to at the beginning, I'll say, I'm not going to see you anymore. Very rarely happens. But nevertheless, that's what that particular visit is about, to introduce what the practice is about. And if this fits their expectations, great. If it doesn't, that's fine. Nice to see you. You might be better off finding another place that fits more with your concept of what the practice should be.
Okay. Let's get to the phones. Thank you for calling in. Melissa and Bridget, go ahead.
Oh, hi. My daughter, she's 2 years old, and we recently saw an ENT specialist at CHEO. He came to the conclusion that she has enlarged adenoids.
Mm-hmm.
So he suggested that we try her on some nasal steroids.
Yes.
To try to shrink them before we result to the surgery.
Correct.
But I was just wondering if this does work, the steroids, can they grow back, and will she be on steroids, I guess, until the age where they they may retract back. And also, I noticed since she's been on the steroid that she's been, you know, playing around in her nose a lot, and it has bled a few times. Mm-hmm. So should I stop using it, or should I continue?
Well, they're actually very good questions, because you have to look at this short versus long term. Adenoids are what we call lymphoid tissue, meaning that they will respond. They're responsible for producing antibodies and other compounds to fight inflammation and infection. And so when you get a cold, for example, that's why you get the glands or lymph nodes in your neck that get bigger. The same thing happens to tonsils and adenoids. They're very similar tissue. For children of a young age, 2 years old, their airways and nasal passages are very small. The diameter and the area is very small. So when the adenoids get larger, they take up a proportionately larger area inside that nasal cavity. As they get older, their nasal cavity gets larger. And as they reach, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age, the ratio or the difference in size now becomes a lot less important. The adenoids don't continue to enlarge as the child gets older. They stay about the same size, but the space in the nasal cavity increases, and so the adenoids cause less of a problem. So you're looking at using the nasal steroids to reduce the inflammation of the adenoids. It can dry out the nose, and they can get some nosebleeds, but you also can use, there's a whole bunch of type of inert gels that you can buy. There's the 3 or 4 different brands, Rhinaris, Sicaris, Rhinolar. There's a whole bunch of them that actually lubricate the nose and prevent the bleeding. But it's always preferable to use the nasal steroid, which, by the way, is extremely safe to use, because there is very little absorption into the overall body. That is, it doesn't get absorbed too much into the bloodstream. And any amount that does get in there, less than 1%, is broken down by the liver and has no effect on them in terms of the steroid effect. So it will shrink down the adenoid tissue and give them literally that buffer time until they get a bit older, and they likely will not have to use the steroid after that, but you've avoided surgery in this case and reduced a lot of trauma that way.
Good luck, Melissa. And we'll get more of your phone calls after the news on CFRA. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday House Call. It's for everyone, folks, the Wednesday House Call, not just the 1%.
I got to get in shape. I got to do this. I do. I either got to get in shape or hope ponchos come back in style. I don't like weight loss advice, because you get weight loss advice from, like, everybody. Everybody thinks they got the secret. There are people coming up to me all the time. You know what you got to do? You got to chew sugarless gum. That's your problem right there. Yeah, because my ass got fat from bazooka. That's where I veered right there. You ever get weight loss advice from someone bigger than you? You know what you gotta do? Yeah, not listen to your fatter ass, for starters. You know what it comes down to? My fitness goals are different than most people's. That's it. That's what I've assessed. Seriously, that's it. Because most people want to lose enough weight so that they look good in a bathing suit, or they want to lower their cholesterol. I just want to lose enough so that my stomach doesn't jiggle when I brush my teeth. That's it. Then it's just maintenance from there on out.
Get back to the phone lines now with Dr. Barry Dworkin. And Kathy, you're up next. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi, I was wondering about blood pressure. There was a test done on my husband because he was having dizzy spells. When he was laying down, his blood pressure was 279 over 140. When they sat him up, his blood pressure was 170 over 100. When they stood him up, it was 75 over 45. What would cause that?
I've never heard of anything like that. That's 279 over 140 is you go to the hospital.
He was in the hospital.
Yeah. Depending if they give him any medication or anything like that when that happened?
No, they took medication away, actually, because they were worried about the side effects of some of them. this has been going on for 3 weeks. He's still having these dizzy spells, and nobody can give us an answer what's causing them. He had CAT scans, he had MRIs, and nothing shows anything. His blood is perfect, no antibody problem, no hemoglobin problem.
But what is his pressure normally? Has he had his blood pressure taken over 24 hours just to see what the average pressure is during the day?
It is a little bit high, but only higher when he's laying down.
Hmm. But you say when he's standing up at 75, does he faint? At 75 over 45,
well,
you'd expect someone to...
He doesn't faint, but his legs get really wobbly, and if you don't put a chair under him, mm-hmm. he'll fall.
Now, when he is standing up, does the pressure go up after a while?
Eventually. Now, sometimes it doesn't drop immediately. Like, he'll walk a little ways and he'll be fine, and then all of a sudden you can see it going to happen, and you take his blood pressure and it just drops.
So what we're looking at is something that is triggering, and if it's always when he changes body position, that is, if he's lying down and the pressure goes up, there are sensors in the body. They're called they're barosensors. They actually will measure pressure, and they're found in the carotid arteries. And sometimes if they're not registering things properly, if they're not measuring pressure properly, it can make the heart work harder and actually cause arteries to constrict more. And baroreceptors, they're called. And that can be one possibility. Has he had his when they looked at the arteries? Did they look at the arteries in the neck? Did they do any Doppler scans or ultrasounds of the neck to look at the arteries in that area?
He had one carotid artery done in July of this past year, but the other one was pretty plugged. But they said that they didn't want to do it. That if, as long as one was open, he was fine.
So when did this start happening? Did this happen after that surgery?
Correct. It's happened only 3 weeks ago. It just came on suddenly, and he had his carotid artery done in July.
Okay. So the question I would have, and again, this is pretty complicated in terms of the history, because I don't have any of his information, but if, again, when you change body position, the body is registering that change in different ways. And so it is assuming that something, it is registering that the pressure seems to be dropping too much, and hence it increases blood pressure when he lies down. But it's doing it with false information, if you understand what I'm trying to say. Is that it's assuming that when you're lying down, it's saying, oh, the pressure looks like it's 80 over 60 when really it isn't, but it's responding the same way and increasing the pressure all the way up, thinking that somehow that is a normal pressure for the body. And so if he had surgery on the carotid artery, an endarterectomy, in other words, to take out some of the cholesterol and plaque that was there, you know, sometimes what happens is you can damage those baroreceptors. And so on one side, they don't work very well. And on the other side, they said that's why if he has one, it'll be okay. But what we have to suspect now, and it's a question to ask them, is has something happened on the other side now? Has the carotid artery on the other side become blocked? Or is the area where you usually find those receptors, which is where the carotid artery divides into two arteries, one that goes into the head, the other one goes up to the face and outside on the skull, is that area now being affected? And if so, maybe those receptors in that, what was considered to be the normal artery, now are they not working properly? And as such, is that what is causing his blood pressure changes? That would be at least a question I would ask on the basis of the information that you've provided.
Okay, let's move along to the next question from John in Ottawa. John.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you, doctor, for making it in today.
Looking
out my front window, it's a blizzard out there.
It's not that bad.
Okay, now I'm taking some antidepressant medication, but it's a herbal form.
Okay.
St. John's wort,
mm-hmm.
and also passion flower.
Okay.
Now, I was concerned in case I also have, I spoke to you about this before, the palpitations and so on, but my doctor has not fully diagnosed what kind of cardiovascular medicine that I might need.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these medications, are there any, the only other thing I take is plain aspirin.
Right.
For my low dose. which my doctor put me on that. Well, I buy it off the shelf, but that's the only other medication. So if I was to be put on some sort of beta blocker, for instance, is there any interaction with these drugs?
I'm actually looking up the drug interactions right now to see what they interact with. Proton pump inhibitors, psychotics. Nothing that talks about beta blockers.
Okay. So now, my medication, the one I'm taking, is herbal. It's not produced by a pharmaceutical company.
Right, but they're all chemicals anyway, so it doesn't really matter that way.
Right.
But in terms of St. John's wort, there's no interaction. It'll interact with blood thinners like Coumadin, sometimes medications for cholesterol, and also other tricyclic antidepressants and medications used to treat elevated acid levels in your stomach.
Okay.
But otherwise, nothing there that will interfere with a beta blocker.
Right. Now, this cholesterol test, I should probably get that done as well.
How old are you?
I'm 61.
Yeah, usually, I mean, for someone who's 60, the only things really to check in terms of blood work are blood sugar and cholesterol.
Okay.
And on the basis of that, you're screening for obviously for early onset or onset of diabetes.
Right.
And also making an assessment on a person's cardiovascular disease risk over a period of 10 years from the time of that blood test.
Right.
So usually you take the person's age, their HDL, their good cholesterol level, their total cholesterol, if there's a family history of heart disease, whether they smoke, and their blood pressure. And on the basis of that, you can put that into a well-documented equation that gives you a percentage risk of developing heart disease over 10 years. And on the basis of that risk, it's divided into three categories, low, medium, and high risk. On the basis of that and the cholesterol results, you can decide on whether it's recommended to be on a medication or not. But it needs that evaluation before that recommendation is done.
Joan and Elmer, you're up next, Joan.
It needs that evaluation before that recommendation is...
Joan's got the radio on. We'll give it another try here. Joan.
Hello.
Yes, Joan, go ahead.
Hi. I recently had a Doppler done on my carotid artery.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing that for 10 years, and it's been around 70. And the last couple of years, they said it's a little bit more. Well, this time I asked them what the little bit more was, and they said 80 to 85.
Mm-hmm.
Should I be scared?
Well, what you're talking about is stenosis or blockage of the carotid arteries.
That's right. What he said I had, a stenosis.
Yeah. Is it on one side or on both sides?
I'm sorry, I didn't ask him.
Because
I'm going to see my GP tomorrow to get it read.
Right, because what you want to know, first off, is what the percentage is, because you have two carotid arteries, obviously, so that if one is blocked but the other one isn't as blocked, they may not want to do much. The other issue is that it's not, although intuitively it sounds the thing to do, in terms of doing what's called an endarterectomy, which is removing the plaque that is causing the blockage, but the outcomes do vary for people, and it really requires the expertise of a cardiovascular surgeon to know whether surgery to fix that is going to be helpful or not, because there is risk of stroke after that type of surgery. And there isn't a guarantee for many people who have it done that it actually prevents some of the negative outcomes. So surgery is, although intuitively you'd say, you remove it and it opens it up and it's better, it doesn't necessarily work out that way. It is a very complex formula in terms of how they decide from a clinical standpoint whether surgery is important. It also depends on the person, male or female, the age, family history. There's other medical conditions. There's a lot of different issues that go into this. So the questions that really you want to discuss with your family doctor tomorrow is whether it's blocked severely on both sides. And if so, you may just want to have a consult to get an opinion about what to do from the specialist who has the experience knowing the outcomes of these different scenarios.
Okay. Last call. Denise.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. I'm calling on behalf of my niece. It started off, we don't have a diagnosis, first of all. It started with 3 weeks' worth of really bad headaches and vision problems.
Mm-hmm.
She went to the emergency and had a spinal tap done, MRI, and a CT scan, and everything came out clear. But they found out that she's got swollen optic nerves and she's got the pressure in her brain of 40. She's gone now to a nutritionist and has been put on an 800-calorie diet. She's lost now approximately 30 pounds, and there's been no change.
Who recommended
you
the dietitian?
You are getting some crazy looks here in the studio about this whole thing, Denise.
Who recommended a dietitian for increased pressure in the head?
Well, because the doctor, I guess, at the emergency said that it would be great if she lost weight.
Yeah, but that's not going to solve the problem. So they said that when they did a lumbar puncture, you said?
Yes.
And they found that the pressure was increased?
Well, they said that, yes.
Okay, so if she has something that is causing what we call increased intracranial pressure, where the optic nerves are swollen, there's some inflammatory process going on in the brain that is leading to that and giving her the headaches. This is not something that I would go straight to weight loss. This requires neurology consult, neurosurgeon to give an opinion about this. If there is documented inflamed optic nerves, something is up. And I would not be taking another day and just deciding, you know, or weeks to see what happens. I would, if she has one, to see her family doctor tomorrow, get those results from the hospital, get a neurology consult, do some blood work to look for any inflammatory processes that can cause inflammation as well, and have this looked at, because that's someone that's having a headache and vision problems with swollen optic nerves. That is not a normal condition at all.
Okay. We have to wrap it up there. We're right out of time. Good luck to everyone.